and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a screen gun.
The last two cycles, I've enjoyed reading the reporting of Daniel Morantz at the Huffington Post. He's taken a very nuanced approach looking at the many diverse voices within today's Democratic Party. His reporting has had him travel to communities large and small in each region of the country, from Texas to Michigan, but specifically we're going to be talking about Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about his recent trip to Northeast PA. He visited Pittston and Honesdale and communities in between. Both these communities are in Congressman Matt Cartwright's district. This is one of the most purple districts in the entire country, and Daniel got a front row seat to how this historic campaign cycle is winding down up there in NEPA. Before we sit down with Daniel, let's go back to the fall of 2020, when a native son of Northeast PA, Joe Biden, did a town hall up in the region.
I really do view this campaign as a campaign between Scranton and Park Avenue. And I really mean it. Because, you know, the way we were raised up here in this area, awful lot of hard work and people busted the neck. All they ask for is a shot.
Daniel Morantz, welcome to my kitchen table.
Great to be here, Ari.
Hey, and welcome back from the hills of Northeast Pennsylvania. You traveled to a place that's near and dear to my heart, my late grandmother's hometown, Honesdale, Pennsylvania. You don't get a lot of New York national reporters going to Wayne County, but look forward to talking about that. But before we go any further, maybe you can share with folks a little about your background and how you landed at the Huffington Post.
Sure, it's a good question. I after graduating college, I actually did some advocacy work for an organization called Social Security Works, but decided I preferred expressing myself without working for an advocacy group and wrapping my head around a broader range of issues. I briefly had a production job on a short-lived news discussion TV show, and then have been here for 7 years, started out as a general assignment reporter in D.C., and really starting after the 2016 election, became one of our politics beat reporters. I focused a lot for a number of years on the internecine dynamics within the Democratic Party and sort of party primaries and the like, and certainly at least for the past two election cycles, I've been one of the anchors of our campaign coverage, and I travel all over the country for that. And thankfully, for well over a year now, back on planes, which makes the job a little easier. And I have found that my perspective as a reporter has grown immensely from really just being in all kinds of different corners of the country and hearing from ordinary people how they think about politics.
So before your adventures up in Northeast PA, which I'm sure will be the highlight of your 2022 travels, what are some other fun places that you went to, some other candidates that you've profiled?
Sure. Well, I did continue to do quite a bit of primary coverage. I spent some time in Texas in February and March to look at, obviously, some of the primaries there. I profiled Nancy Mace, who is a Republican in the Low Country of South Carolina, who had a primary challenger backed by Donald Trump because she had criticized him, not because she had voted to impeach him. And there was a similar race, but in this case, he did vote to impeach, and that was Peter Meyer in Western Michigan, and he was ousted. So I spent some time in Western Michigan and in Detroit, actually covering an interesting sort of mainstream Democrat versus progressive Democrat, Haley Stevens versus Andy Levin. It was a major litmus test of sort of, frankly, the issue of U.S. policy toward Israel in that race. And since that time, I would say I was our main person covering the open New York 10th congressional district, and which had 12 major candidates. And of course, Dan Goldman walked away from that here and the primary was the main battle there. There was a special election in upstate New York that I covered. And more recently, I have, of course, I think really been dedicating most of my time in terms of travel to Pennsylvania, though I will be tagging along with Beto O'Rourke later this week in Texas.
So,
or next week,
rather. I assume it wasn't too tough a sell to your editors and your colleagues that you wanted to go to down I-80, down the GW Bridge from Manhattan to Northeast Pennsylvania. But why specifically there? You know, frankly, too often national reporters, they go to the Philadelphia suburbs because I guess suppose geographically it's the easiest from New York and D.C. and the airport. But what was it about Northeast Pennsylvania?
It's a good question. Well, 2 years ago, Cartwright had always sort of intrigued me a little bit. Matt Cartwright, who is the member of Congress there and what's currently known as Pennsylvania's 8th Congressional District. It really covers the vast majority of Northeast Pennsylvania, including the key metropolitan areas of Scranton, Pittston, Wilkes-Barre, Nanticoke, Hazleton, and sort of the smaller towns up in the Poconos. And he struck me as unique because, unlike many Democrats in marginal districts, and especially marginal districts that weren't marginal because they were in the suburbs that used to be sort of Romney Republican suburbs, but are in kind of traditional, what are thought of as white working class strongholds. These are areas that swung very heavily toward Trump. And I was sort of intrigued by how he held on despite that, and intrigued by the fact that, unlike many Democrats in similar positions, notably, of course, Joe Manchin, but there are a number of others, he isn't all that moderate. And in fact, he's a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and has a number of pretty staunch progressive views. So that was always intriguing to me. And I just said to my boss, here's a guy that I find interesting. Here's why. And apparently I'm going to get access. I was already, frankly, going to be in Pennsylvania to cover John Fetterman's rally in Philadelphia and sort of do something about the whole question of the city of Philadelphia, because, as you know, the suburbs are kind of what gets all the action. I think that Northeast Pennsylvania will be important in both statewide races, but as I think we'll get into, it's a little harder to extrapolate from just how well Matt Cartwright does, relatively speaking, because he has done such a good job of distinguishing himself from other Democrats and sort of creating a permission structure for people who might be hesitant to embrace the party or the party's candidates to make an exception and say, well, this isn't just a Democrat, it's Matt. And I know Matt Cartwright.
I think that final point, you just hit the nail on the head. We increasingly have listeners far, far beyond Pennsylvania's borders. So just to put a little background, so Congressman Cartwright is in Speaker Pelosi's leadership team. He's what they call an appropriations cardinal, so a subcommittee chair of Commerce, Justice, and Science. But he actually won back in 2012 by primarying a sitting, fairly senior Democrat. So I don't know, you mentioned you've been at this for 7 years, and it's fascinating. I know we have listeners from all diverse backgrounds, but looking, and I think you used the word internecine, looking at these kind of fissures that happen internally in the Democratic Party. It's a very interesting beat that you've developed, Daniel. So maybe you could speak to that. I mean, a lot has happened since that 2012 primary race when Matt Cartwright won against Tim Holden in Pennsylvania, Democratic circles and beyond. So,
yeah, there are so many different things that I could just briefly note about that 2012 primary. Republicans in Pennsylvania actually drew that district as a Democratic vote sink. That's how much sort of the correlation between certain demographics and political leanings has changed in 10 years, but really in 5 or 6 or 7 years time. This was a traditional sort of place where the blue collar white communities felt still a strong kinship with labor unions. Luzerne County was a county that President Obama won twice. That's the county with Wilkes-Barre. Lackawanna continues to go for Democrats at the presidential level. That's where Scranton is, but by a narrower margin. And so Tim Holden was actually on the outskirts of that district, if not from outside of the district and having to move in order to preserve his incumbency. So I think that was that's the really sort of deciding factor as to why he lost in that primary. But it's an interesting story, again, because actually Cartwright was to his left. And one of the issues on which he was to his left was that he wanted tougher regulation of fracking. He wanted to get rid of what was known as, at that time, as the Halliburton loophole, which I don't exactly know the details of, but essentially it meant that this newer technology of hydraulic fracturing, which again is doing horizontal drilling into the Earth's surface to extract natural gas from various shale reserves, some of which are in Northeast Pennsylvania and in North Central Pennsylvania, and then others of which are in Southwestern Pennsylvania. So obviously fracking is very important to the state. And he was able to prevail. One of the reasons I think he was able to prevail then and continues to enjoy some goodwill now is that he's sort of part of this popular trial law firm dynasty in the Scranton area. And my sense is that blue collar people in physical jobs actually really appreciate trial lawyers, because if they can't get what they need from the insurance company or from the government, that's kind of their only recourse. And so these aren't sort of seen as nasty and nefarious lawyers, as some kinds of subspecialties of the legal profession are. But for the longest time, the Munley Law Firm, which used to be called Munley, Munley and Cartwright, which was Cartwright's father-in-law, wife, and him, but now is just Cartwright's wife, father-in-law, and a lot of her siblings and other family members. This is sort of a ubiquitous symbol in and around Scranton. There's a lot of billboard advertising. It's well known. And I think it has also, frankly, given him access to a healthy Rolodex of donors and just general ability to gain influence within the Democratic Party. And so you fast forward, 2016, though, he underperformed Trump in his own district. Trump carried that seat by over 10 points. And I believe that year Cartwright did about five and a half over his opponent. So that I think was a real wake-up call. Something's changed here. Trump has electrified, in some cases, new voters who don't frequently vote, or is just convincing what are known as ancestral Democrats, people who had these historic ties to the Democratic Party, but where the ideology was increasingly up for grabs at the very least, to sort of just maybe go R all the way down the ticket, vote Republican up and down the ballot. And I think that was a real turning point.
And it wasn't too long ago that former President Trump was there in the district at the Mohegan Sun Arena. And, you know, I don't remember, I honestly did not watch the rally, but I don't know to what extent the Cartwright race was the focus versus the statewide races. But, you know, maybe if you could just share with listeners a bit about Congressman Cartwright's opponent, and if he gave you access, and if not, were there surrogates from his
opponent? Unfortunately, he did not give me access. There are party organizations who did speak to me, the National Republican Congressional Committee, which is sort of the campaign arm for House Republicans. I did speak to a Republican consultant out of Pittsburgh, who obviously it's a different part of the state, but people are sort of familiar with the Cartwright phenomenon and still sort of say to me, sometimes on record, sometimes anonymously. I did cite somebody anonymously, but he is a high-ranking senior national Republican figure. You know, they will admit that he's sort of, Cartwright is kind of a conundrum to them. And they'll say, we like how we feel about flipping Connor Lamb's old seat, which is now Pennsylvania 17th, where Chris DeLuzio is running. It's actually a seat that Biden carried by almost 6 points, but it's an open seat, and it's in a part of the country where they like the demographic shift in some similar ways to the Cartwright seat. And then they feel confident about ousting Susan Wild in the Lehigh Valley area because they feel that they have a good candidate running against her, Lisa Scheller. And so I think if we're going to talk about Cartwright's opponent, Jim Bognet, Bognet is a sort of veteran Republican political operative. He was the policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign. He ultimately came on into an advisory. He then bounced around different lobbying consulting jobs in D.C., though the most notorious of those jobs, he was not officially a registered lobbyist. Now, those who know the influence industry in D.C. know that only a fraction of the people who actually do lobbying are officially registered. Frankly, the rules aren't very well enforced, but there's also a lot of ways to effectively be lobbyist adjacent without committing 20% of your time or more in such a way that you would even legally technically be required to register as a lobbyist. But he was with the Glover Park Group, which is really one of the powerhouse bipartisan DC lobbying shops. And what we're now seeing is Cartwright sort of hit him on the fact that the firm itself, at a time when Bocnet was a communications vice president for the firm, had taken on the Saudi government as one of its clients at a time when the Saudis were fighting the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, which would have allowed, for example, the families who suffered, families of victims of 9/11, to sue the Saudis for alleged ties to what occurred on 9/11. So he's a guy who's been in DC for a long time. He did serve in the Trump administration. The chronology escapes me as to whether he was at Glover Park Group first or after his stint at the Export-Import Bank for Trump. And then, of course, he ran in 2020, and he returned home for that. But I think that was a challenge for him to some extent, to be able to sort of reestablish himself as a local person rather than a DC person, whereas Cartwright can say he's been in the Scranton area for 34 years. And that's the kind of thing that is important in a place like that. I think what Bocnet is hoping and what his national Republican allies are hoping is twofold. One is that they have a stat that is accurate, which is that Cartwright has voted with Biden 100% of the time. Now, I think he's distinguished himself from the progressive wing on a couple of key issues in ways that are meaningful, but Biden's brand is not doing great across the country. I haven't looked at district-specific polling, but I have no reason to think that a largely white and blue-collar corner of Pennsylvania, that Biden's numbers, despite him coming from Scranton, are any better in Northeast Pennsylvania. So they hope that whatever affinity, personal affection people have for Cartwright, that they can overcome that by just tying him to the president. And then the second thing is they have this sort of idea that Cartwright isn't this folksy guy that he said, that he leads you to believe he is. He's made a lot of money as a trial lawyer. He's got a yacht and a house on Lake George in upstate New York. And he's gotten, his wealth has grown steadily over his time in Congress. He remains a part owner of of the law firm, the Munley Law Firm in the Scranton area, and thus sort of a beneficiary of passive income from that. And that he's sort of supported legislation that's been helpful to trial lawyers that has probably, in theory, been in his own interest as well. Though, of course, he denies that that's been his motivation. So that's basically where Bocnet is. I mean, if you think about, again, this importance of reintroducing himself, having spent so much time in D.C., two of his television ads talk about a game-winning field goal he apparently kicked as a member of Hazleton Area Regional High School in the early 1990s. So he's really trying to emphasize that and sort of turn the tables on Cartwright in that respect.
Well, I definitely appreciate that perspective. I know listeners do as well. Yeah, you spent time in both Pittston and Honesdale on this trip. You mentioned Scranton. You mentioned Nanticoke. You don't hear a lot of guys out of Manhattan talking about Nanticoke. And now you're talking about Hazleton. I suppose everywhere in Pennsylvania congressional districts, this district is, you know, it's very much communities and people are very much proud of their community. And there's a lot of diversity as you go to these different communities. So I'd be curious, you know, your time in Pittston, were you generally hearing the same themes, the same presentation from the candidate versus your time in Honesdale? And, you know, what's top of mind, at least from your reporting trip there?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think that Cartwright probably modifies his emphasis a little bit in front of Democratic audiences. He'll talk more about the need to elect Josh Shapiro for governor and John Fetterman for Senate. But he's also careful, and he doesn't want to tell Democratic activists something that he couldn't stand behind in front of independents or Republicans in the district. And so I recount this anecdote, for example, where he was sort of denouncing the fact that Doug Mastriano doesn't accept the Republican nominee for governor, doesn't accept the sort of veracity of the results of the 2020 presidential election, and in his opinion is anti-democratic. And a woman in the crowd said, "Fascism, fascism." And he just said, "There's that F word again." And kind of people laughed, but he wouldn't endorse the statement because he can't brand a movement even adjacent to so many of his own constituents with that moniker. He doesn't see any utility in it. I didn't even get to how he actually feels about it, its applicability, but he just thinks that it's associated with such extreme ideologies that there's no use in doing that. And frankly, in demonizing people who voted for Trump, that's not something that he's willing to do. I did get a chance to, I didn't witness the conversation, but I got a chance to see him catching up with a man at a donut shop in Pittston who he'd run into, who had asked for personal advice. And he sort of took time out of his afternoon to sit down with the guy. The guy's last name is Hughes. His first name escapes me. But, you know, this was an older blue collar guy who told me afterwards that he has a lot of conservative views, that he sort of thinks that the environmentalists have gone too far, and that generally, like, the border needs to be closed, and Democrats haven't done enough on that. And he was aware that Cartwright was more liberal than him on that, and he wouldn't explicitly tell me he was voting for Cartwright, but he had nothing but good things to say about him, and specifically the idea that he was just willing to sit down with him and give him advice. That's the kind of thing that Cartwright has done to be able to distinguish himself. Another thing that he's done is, again, being a cardinal on the Appropriations Committee, as you note, he's a major source of federal funding for a district that is not necessarily economically flourishing and in many cases is economically depressed. He's bringing in federal money for schools, libraries, sort of fire stations, new research branches at the University of Scranton, which is a major employer in that city. And I think this is also critical because it is a case where he was willing to run against Brand. And that is that he claims some credit for helping lure a natural gas refinery into the district, which would convert natural gas, much of which is extracted locally in Pennsylvania, into gasoline that could be used by cars. Now, the claims of this industry, and my understanding is the science backs this up as well, is that that produces fewer emissions, in fact, a significantly smaller amount of emissions than it refining oil into gasoline. And so it has some environmental benefit, but I think to locals, it's about his commitment to delivering decent paying jobs and many union jobs, as the case happens to be. And also his willingness to not sort of just fall in line with what they regard as progressive environmental orthodoxy coming out of Washington or other places, that at the end of the day, this guy, he might have some progressive positions. He's extremely pro-choice. As I know, he's also a supporter of Medicare for all. But this is still the kind of thing where he'll put the district first in their opinion. And it's also then the kind of thing that he can put in TV ads. You know, he's not putting Medicare for all in TV ads. And that's his right, because that's not the kind of wedge issue that drives people to the polls. He is putting the fact that he ultimately voted for a Biden bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, that will empower Medicare to negotiate bulk rates on prescription drugs. So there are some sort of mainline Democratic Party things that even in a district like that obviously poll well, because a candidate like Cartwright's not going to put it in an ad if it doesn't poll well.
So you've been super generous with your time. We have, there's some offices that are actually counting down the hours until Election Day. I'm not sure you are, but, you know, we are in a matter of days and early ballots are flying out there. So you headed back to Pennsylvania? And if so, what themes are you going to be looking for in the final closing arguments of these campaigns?
Yeah, so I am headed back to Pennsylvania at least once, but hopefully more than that. I anticipate being there this weekend to attend a rally that John Fetterman is hosting in York County. One of the questions I'm interested in exploring is, this is a candidate who built himself during the primary as somebody who would have greater appeal in rural counties where Democrats really could benefit from an extra 5 or 10 points in some cases, but don't have hope to win, but certainly have hope to do better, just in the same way that Dr. Oz is hoping to make a dent in Philadelphia, right? I mean, Republicans tell me that if Dr. Oz can get 18, 19, 20% in Philadelphia, then Fetterman has no chance. So that these are very incremental margins, but things that matter to both parties. And yet Fetterman currently is doing worse than Shapiro at the top of the ticket in these rural counties, in large part because he sustained a well-funded candidate's attacks, and Shapiro is not up against a well-funded candidate. And also because Fetterman has taken some progressive stances on criminal justice reform that lend themselves or provide a greater opening for Republicans. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in ticket splitters. The idea of people who might vote for Shapiro, but then also Dr. Oz for Senate, or even people who might vote for Fetterman and Mastriano for governor. I mean, I'm still open to that being a possibility, or we're generally voting Republican down ballot, but having kind of a soft spot for Fetterman being sort of independent and having a maybe a more rural aesthetic at the very least. And finally, I would say I'm interested in Shapiro as a figure who has national potential. I think everybody thinks right now this is somebody who's highly favored to be elected governor of Pennsylvania. This is somebody who already won his first term in 2016 in a year when just about no other Democrat won statewide in Pennsylvania. Again, that cycle when everybody got blindsided and he pulled it off. If he pulls that off a second time, again, in a midterm election that is not, that with a Democrat in the White House that is, despite sort of some of the renewed enthusiasm over the Supreme Court's abortion ruling, is generally viewed as something that could be where as a cycle where Republicans have the headwinds blowing in their direction, he's going to be on the short list for, frankly, presidential contenders. And I want to know a little bit about what he's about and what his formula is.
So I got so many more questions. You have so many more road miles. I do have one final question to that point. You know, when you're up there in a small community like Honesdale, where probably every Democratic activist knows one another, all the super voters, probably both parties, you know, more or less know their elected officials on the county level. Did you get the sense that there's going to be, is there strong enthusiasm, for example, for the Cartwright campaign, but not necessarily one of these others? Or did you see kind of a hand in glove Democratic operation with the Shapiro Davis signs, the Fetterman signs, the Cartwright signs, et cetera?
It's a good question. I think that...
Or was it only, I guess my point is, was it only the Cartwright wearing the Democratic badge showing up and having conversations in a community where there's probably more people in some apartment buildings in Manhattan than live in Honesdale?
Yeah, I think that Democratic activists are fired up about the whole ticket. I think that, you know, you get into kind of the more moderate Republican or centrist independent voters. I think that you might, at least the conversations I had there suggested a greater openness to Cartwright first, and then maybe Shapiro after that, and then Fetterman. There's just the sense that, you know, I think there's a sense among some Republicans that they don't want to elect a guy who is in really a Trump dead ender, proverbially, and that would be Doug Mastriano. I think that there's a sense among those same Republicans, well, Cartwright's a guy we know and we personally really like him and he's done a lot for the district. If you're that person and you still want to maybe exercise a check on President Biden's power, or you just, on an emotional level, you can't put D up and down the ticket, my sense is that Dr. Oz is the guy you sort of say, well, at least I can vote Republican for U.S. Senate. Now, this is to say nothing, of course, of state legislature. I mean, there are a lot of different options. But the thing about Dr. Oz is I don't think he has a very high favorability rating statewide in Pennsylvania, but I don't think that he evokes the same kinds of fears in moderate voters or independent-minded voters that a figure like Mastriano does. And so that is something to watch. And I think one thing that I don't preclude, frankly, is we don't exactly know how all this is going to turn out. And the economy is still sort of a real variable in the final weeks here. And, you know, there is, you know, the fundamental environment, I think, is still favorable to Republicans. I think Democrats have generally done a better job recruiting candidates, and they have some offset from the abortion rights effect. But I think Cartwright could simply lose because he's getting washed out by the tide, not because he did anything that he shouldn't have done as a candidate. And that is that's sort of the nature of the beast. And it should definitely be something interesting to watch. But there are plenty of lawns out there in Northeast Pennsylvania that have every yard sign as a Republican except for Cartwright. And that was true last cycle, too. So it's if there's anybody who could do it, it's him. And that's definitely one reason why I think it's an interesting thing to watch. As I sort of note in this piece, this has become increasingly rare. The idea that somebody who identifies as a Republican would vote for a Democrat used to be commonplace, and vice versa. And it's become increasingly rare in a country where there's such deep national and sometimes what we call negative polarization, right? Where you're not just polarized in favor of your camp, but against the other camp. And so having a figure like him, another person I point to is Jared Golden in rural northeastern Maine. He's the only other House Democrat running for re-election in a seat that Trump carried twice. These are interesting figures to watch for evidence that it is possible to defy those polarization trends.
Dan, I got so many more questions. I really appreciate it. It's going to be a fascinating, fascinating ride. Use the Northeast PA analogy. We need a tray of Old Forge pizza to get us through because it's going to be some late nights. All right. Thank you so much, and good luck on the trail.
All right. Thank you, Ari. Great being here.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too, at PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week.